Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group and the George Mason Law School's Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. It was held on Thursday, April 11, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the current status of patent law, and our co-sponsor for today's call is the George Mason Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we are happy to welcome back as our moderator, Professor Adam Mossoff. In addition to his professorship at George Mason University School of Law and his participation in the leadership of the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, he's the co-founder of CPIP at George Mason. That's the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property, our co-sponsor today. He's going to introduce our expert and then lead the discussion, and I will check back with you when just before we take questions from you, the audience. So with that, Professor Mossoff, please go right ahead with your program.
Thank you, Dean. It's a real pleasure to be here today, and I'm particularly honored to be to have as our guest discussant for this digital equivalent of a fireside chat, Chief Judge Randall Rader of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Judge Rader began his long and distinguished career as a jurist when he was first appointed to the United States Claims Court in 1988, the predecessor court to what is now called the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. He was elevated to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in 1990 and then assumed the duties of Chief Judge on June 1st, 2010. Judge Rader is not just a jurist, he's also a distinguished professor, having taught courses in patent law and other advanced intellectual property topics at the George Washington University Law School, the University of Virginia School of Law, Georgetown University Law Center, and the Munich Intellectual Property Law Center, as well as at university programs in Tokyo, Taipei, New Delhi, and Beijing. He's also a co-author of several texts in patent law, including a casebook and The Ubiquitous Patent Law in a Nutshell. Judge Rader has, of course, many other awards and distinguished achievements, has been a longstanding international speaker about the patent system in the United States and its virtues and values, and so we're very honored to have him here today for our teleforum. The format of our call will be that Judge Rader will speak for approximately 5 to 7 minutes. We will then have a short back and forth question and answer with me for about 15 or so minutes, and then we will open it up at around 2:30 to questions from the audience. So without much further ado, Judge Rader.
Thank you, Adam and Dean, and I'm happy to be with everybody. It's rather strange to not know who you're talking to, but that might have some advantages too. But I'm pleased to kind of kick this off by some observations I had recently. I just returned early this morning from Brazil. And while in Brazil, I had a rather significant meeting with the Development Bank there, the largest development bank in the world, actually. They have $800 billion, which they put into startup ventures in Brazil. And the interesting part of this meeting is we spent a good deal of time, several hours, with leading policymakers there at the bank. And they were looking at intellectual property as a leading indicator of a successful business enterprise. If you had intellectual property, that was kind of a hallmark that it was likely to succeed rather than sink into oblivion quickly, as startups have a good chance of doing. And they were very optimistic about the role of intellectual property and giving them signals about the economy and about growth and about their role in the future international market. And I kind of contrasted that and the enthusiasm I felt there from them and the excitement in the conference there in Brazil. And I kind of contrasted that with my return here to the United States, where as I dived back into my casework and my work with the court, I realized that I'm dealing with so many issues which are reminiscent of a past era of patent failure. I thought back to the days when Giles Rich was kind of holding down the fort alone at the Court of Customs and Patent Appeals as the Patent Act was being shredded by various forces here and there. And I don't want to be over-maudlin about the attacks on the patent system, but I do think there's kind of a contrast as I go to China and Japan and Taiwan and even London and Germany, and I see such enthusiasm for the way the system is helping their startup companies get a foothold in the international economy, and they're full of interest to know about what's going on in the United States. And it's I don't feel that same enthusiasm and energy in the intellectual property community here in the United States at all. And we could talk for 20 minutes or 20 hours or 20 days about the various sources, but the biggest part of it is just that the patent system is being blamed for a lot of things it's not designed to do. It's mostly being assailed because it's a source of litigation abuse. Well, if there's litigation abuse, you deal with the problem. You don't eviscerate the property rights system, which has been the strength and the backbone of the American economy for probably the 30 years since the creation of the Federal Circuit and more. So I wonder if we have cause to reflect on whether we, the visionaries who set this system in motion so magnificently with our Constitution over 200 years ago, have lost the vision of what we created. With that word or two, Adam, let's go on into questions.
Certainly. Thank you for that very interesting opening remarks about the contrasts between other countries' embrace of intellectual property and patents and the current tenor of the debates, the policy debates and legal debates in the United States at this time. I'd like to pick up on your remarks about about some of the concerns expressed about what is being referred to today as abusive patent litigation. And
sure.
There seems to be a lot of interest in Congress and the FTC about responding to this issue, either through new legislation such as the SHIELD Act or new regulations at the FTC where they're investigating what they're referring to as patent assertion entities, which suggests that they, at least from the perspective of Congress and the FTC, think that the courts seem to be unable to address this problem, if there is a problem. So as a preliminary matter, I'd be interested to ask you, as someone who's worked as both a trial judge and as an appellate judge in our court system for well over two decades, could you speak to how judges have handled concerns about abusive litigation?
Well, in the first place, I think we're the ones that are doing the most to address the problems. And I would ask you to reflect a minute on the outset of the patent reform debate that started about a decade ago with the studies from the National Science Foundation and various other entities. The FTC had a series of reports, and you remember that there was a great debate over many years in Congress over the and the congressional reforms raged around, the wars kind of raged around damages reform and and venue reform and injunction reform. And it's interesting that none of those appeared in the bill that finally passed with great celebrations a little over a year ago, because most of those subjects had been addressed significantly by Congress, by the courts, not by Congress. And Congress, unable to reach agreement, had left it to the courts, and we indeed had addressed that. So I think just looking at the history suggests that of the last decade suggests that the courts are more equipped to deal with litigation abuse. And again, it's not a flaw in the patent system. This is a litigation abuse problem, and it's not unique to patent law. We've had the tort reform debates, which similarly kind of collapsed into inaction in Congress. We've had every area of federal litigation has kind of been subject to this trial lawyer abuse syndrome, where there's always an effort to get more than is deserved through the judicial system. That kind of abuse needs to be curbed.
So do you think that there is actually any reliable or definitive evidence that you've seen that this is actually a systemic problem in patent litigation that requires legislative or regulatory response? I think that this is somewhat
absolutely
implicit.
None. I've seen absolutely nothing that says it's the patent law. Remember, patent law has one purpose. It doesn't have a purpose of regulating healthcare prices, or a purpose of regulating consumer fairness or competition policy. It has one purpose, and that is to produce new and innovative technology. It is to, well, the Constitution said it best, Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts. And it's the progress of science and the useful arts we're concerned about in the patent field. And that goes on apace, although as you chop away at the incentives and the resources for that kind of investment in the future, it inevitably has to decline. That's the sad thing, that the litigation abuse and the misdirected efforts to correct that are striking at our technology core, not at the litigation, which is the problem.
Could you speak more generally about what are some of the more general litigation problems that you see that are actually reflective?
Oh yeah, that's simple. The biggest, sure. The quick answer to that: it's whenever someone asserts a patent or any other federal rights far beyond its worth and value, and that's what is happening far too often. Is that? And it isn't one kind of entity either. It happens with companies and as well as these entities which seek to do kind of property reclamation work in the patent area. The problem is when those rights are asserted far beyond their contribution to technology, far beyond the advance that they have actually contributed to the field of art that they are making some contribution to. Now, there are other symptoms of that. Excessive discovery. Discovery has lost its moorings completely. That it was a Actually, it's a rather new experiment. It really came into the forefront of American litigation just in the 60s that you'd have this extensive discovery. It was really a creation of the academics of our legal community as they propounded the idea that if all the cards were put on the table, people would be able to settle, which in its kind of simple expression has a lot of strength to it. But the trouble is, as we all know, it's become a strategy in and of itself that you try to so bludgeon your opponent with discovery that they are forced to settle before reaching the merits of cases. And so this has become a strategy, not a positive part of our system. And we need to just cut that out at the roots.
So we're dealing with, in effect, the law of unintended consequences of when someone has a something that sounds beautiful in theory, but yet in practice they don't account for all of the ways that there can be rent-seeking behavior and strategic manipulation of the rules.
Boy, you're right about that. You're right on it.
Well, that's very interesting. And to come back to and to tie this back in a little bit to your statements a few minutes ago about the purpose of the patent law in producing new innovative technology that's rooted in the constitutional injunction to Congress that it shall promote the progress of the useful arts. I'm interested perhaps in coming back to a recent proposed fix to the so-called fix, perhaps to the patent system, which is the SHIELD Act, which was reintroduced in Congress on March 1st, and singles out a specific type of patent owner, what some people call non-practicing entities. I prefer to call them simply patent licensing companies. And creates for these specific patent owners a losing patent owner pays litigation system just for these patent owners. This proposed legislation is being offered as a solution to what many think is abusive patent litigation. What are your thoughts about this? What are your thoughts about perhaps the SHIELD Act? And more generally, do you think it makes sense to create different types of legal rules for different types of patent owners that in effect weaken or make it harder for them to enforce their patents?
In a few simple words, I have to say first that, of course, I don't intervene in legislative debates, but just speaking kind of professorially about the subject area, whenever you try to mete out justice and assign rights based on characteristics of parties rather than the merits of the litigation, you have gone astray. We don't do this in our justice system. Any judge will tell you, you don't decide that someone deserves more or less protection because they're a big company or a small company or a domestic company or a foreign company or of a different race or a different ethnicity. We try to eradicate those irrelevant criteria from the process and decide it on the facts and the law. Now, I completely endorse the idea of reversing the fees when there's a lack of proportionality. What I mean by that is when a litigant of any variety, corporate, non-corporate, individual, collective, I don't care who the entity is or what characteristics it has, university, non-university, it doesn't matter. When they assert a patent, or any other federal right for that matter, for $10 billion and then receive $10,000, that lack of proportionality is itself a reason to reverse the fees. Okay, maybe you won a pittance, but you didn't ask for a pittance and you didn't tax the entire judicial system for a pittance. You were asking for much more, and that lack of proportionality, I think, would be the key to reversal of fees and maybe even stronger sanctions.
That's interesting, because I was just going to ask you what type of reforms would you perhaps propose if you didn't think the SHIELD Act was the answer. So you preempted my next question. I suppose I would ask two questions on the basis of that comment, which is do judges currently have the legal tools and existing procedural capabilities to enact that type of reform?
Yes and no. As you know, if we can call it an extraordinary case, then under the patent law, an extraordinary case can result in the award of costs and fees to the non-prevailing party. Notice the difference, though, in the situation I just said. The patent asserter asked for $10 billion and got $10,000. Now they'll say, well, we won, so you can't reverse the fees on us. I am suggesting that would justify a finding of an extraordinary case, that you have not won. You have instead imposed on the system a tremendous burden for which you should pay. Now, what I'm kind of highlighting here is I'm not sure our case law at the moment allows an extraordinary case in those circumstances, but that's the direction I think it ought to go.
And this is something that can be developed through judicial interpretation of those types of procedural limitations imposed upon litigants.
Hope so.
So I would this has been very interesting, because we've primarily been focusing upon litigation concerns and issues. But as many of the listeners know, this is just part and parcel of a larger and broader patent reform debate that is still ongoing even after the enactment of the American Vents Act in 2011. So in Congress, various bills have continued to be discussed, as including bills relating to the International Trade Commission. Of course, the Federal Trade Commission has already taken action in reaching settlements with Bosch and Google on their standard essential patents, restricting their abilities to bring patent infringement actions in certain circumstances. And of course, the FTC has an ongoing investigation of, as I mentioned earlier, of the activities of what it's calling patent assertion entities, which is a new term for the non-practicing entities.
And they're guessing at what they are, by the way, you notice. They're guessing at what they are. And by the way, these people can perform a very constructive role in the property rights system of technology rights. If they assert patents at a reasonable rate, they can, in a sense, make the ideas and the technology in those instruments more widely and quickly available to others, and they can perform kind of the classic role of a realtor, you know, facilitating quick and easy cooperation, international cooperation, to solve human problems through technology. So there's nothing wrong with these entities. And by the way, they're kind of quasi-political objectives here. You have manufacturing entities, to use manufacturing entities as opposed to non-practicing entities, but they're non-practicing in the sense that they don't have the technology themselves, and it's impossible for them to invent everything anymore. And it is some bright young kid in Bangalore who's coming up with the software combined with the technology ideas of some professor in Chengdu and some startup company in Dusseldorf. And these entities can facilitate the combination, cooperation, and then innovation in the marketplace. But see, the manufacturers want control of all of that. And it escapes their control when all these people have the ability to contribute their brilliance to the system. Well, they don't like that loss of control. They want the old system where Thomas Edison invited all the engineers to his laboratory and invented everything for the world and then controlled it for the world. It just doesn't work that way anymore in an open information, open market information system. And so they are the ones that are going to Congress with their clout and their lobbying dollars and saying, put us back in charge. Get these kids from Bengaluru and professors from Chengdu out of the game. We want to decide what the products will be and control them. They're going to fail. The market has already moved to an international market in ideas and technology. The patent system facilitates that. They won't be able to shut down the free market of ideas and the interchange, but that's what they're resisting. And so you kind of have to feel these forces at work and realize that the lobbyists aren't always giving you the whole story.
So it sounds like you're somewhat skeptical of the rhetoric that is being deployed in the policy and legal debates at the moment, in that that what it sounds like that you're saying that patent licensing, which is what these companies do, and patent manufacturing, which is what other entities do, are both aspects of what it means to to have property rights in patented innovation.
I wish I'd said it that well, Adam. That's you're exactly right.
Oh, thank you. I didn't mean to. So, do you think that it has been a key to the U.S. patent system in terms of promoting the useful arts, promoting new technological innovation, that the patent system has treated equally all types of different types of owners, focusing instead on with the laws where on behavior and on standards of patentability, not on ownership status?
Yes, that is exactly the way the system ought to work. You build fences around your property, you tend your fences, and then when somebody's cattle strays onto your property, you round them up and you remove the trespasser, and if they've done any damage, they pay for it. But they don't pay far beyond the repair of the fence, which is the only damage they did. And that's the problem, is that once the cattle are on your property, you say that, they've taken everything I ever owned and my family, and I deserve billions in return, and that's not accurate.
Oh, excellent. Interesting. So I think we've touched on a lot of different issues. I'm sure that we've said some things that our audience is interested perhaps in following up on or asking us about some other issues that we haven't yet talked about. So, Dean, I think at this point it would be nice to open up to the audience and let them start asking some questions.
Very good. Thanks. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Judge Rader or even Adam Mossoff, I'm sure Adam would be happy to answer your questions, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So stand by for that announcement. So once again, if you have a question for Judge Rader or for Professor Adam Mossoff, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting for that first question, maybe I can make a quick programming announcement, if you don't mind. We have one more Teleforum conference call this week. It'll be tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Time at the same number. We'll be looking at the role the Pentagon and the NSA can and should play in domestic cybersecurity, turning their sights inward rather than outward. And next week, we have a full slate of Teleforum conference calls, one each business day next week. Take a look at the Federalist Society website for an update. One in particular I want to draw your attention to on Monday the 15th at 4 p.m. Eastern time, a somewhat late start time for us. We'll be hosting a special Teleform conference call launching a new project of the Federalist Society, the Executive Branch Overreach Project, with a special Teleform conference call at 4, featuring Federalist Society founder David McIntosh and Senator Mike Lee. Adam, it looks like we've got two callers with questions so far. Why don't we go to our first caller?
Excellent.
Hi, I'm Chris Garvey. I'm a patent attorney and a libertarian. And most of my time, I haven't done a lot of patent litigation lately. Most of my time, I'm representing individual inventors, although I do have a couple of corporate clients. And one of the things about being an individual inventor is if you don't have the resources to produce and sell this product, or even worse, sometimes you can get it built and manufactured, but you can't get it distributed through the large chains that have replaced all the ma-and-pa hardware stores. So you really don't know what inventions are going to be able to be practiced or be marketable or be given the resources of a large corporation. And you are forced to be a non-practicing entity because you don't have the resources to practice. And you're trying to sell this brilliant idea to a lot of other companies, and if they can just say, well, there's no way this guy is ever going to litigate against us because he can't possibly afford the burdens that losing in the status of a non-practicing entity would impose on him, they can just tell the individual inventors to go jump in a lake. We'll take your idea and walk away with it, and there's nothing you can do about it simply because you don't have the resources.
This is Chief Judge Rader again. I really hadn't thought a lot about the injustice on that side of the equation. I see often the injustice on the other side of the equation, where the patent owner is trying to extort more value than the property right has contributed to the field of technology, but I certainly acknowledge that there's a good chance of the injustice you also suggest.
Well, also if he's asking for, well, he doesn't know what the damages are until he gets a report of what the other side has sold, so you know, if the other side, if it's so not valuable, then what's the problem of accepting an injunction? And not having to practice this thing anymore. Also, it seems to me on the reform issue that every reform that's come out of Congress has placed increasing burdens either through fees or through procedural difficulties on the small inventor.
That is, you're stating rather well kind of what I've suggested, that there is a tendency to blame the patent system when its only job is to produce technology. It's not supposed to correct all the litigation abuse, all the consumer fairness issues, all the other aspects of this problem that we hear so much about in the debates.
And that the questioner actually raises an interesting point too about some of the difficulties for small inventors or small companies with some patents or individual inventors, in the sense that when they're seeking an injunction, what they're seeking is the right to actually enter into licensing negotiations with a larger manufacturing entity. And this comes back to I think your earlier point, Judge Rader, about you think that they perhaps should be reversing fees when you have this lack of proportionality. How would you perhaps take into account some of these issues about the kind of uncertainties ex ante about what type of damages or what might the reasonable royalty rate be, especially when you're talking about a small individual inventor?
That, again, is going to be measured mostly by the facts of each case, Adam, and that's why there's a value in judicial implementation of this kind of reform. You know, Congress passes some law and it says, well, if you meet the following three criteria and you sue for a patent infringement and don't win, you have forfeited all, you put yourself at great jeopardy. You're going bankrupt, not them. And of course, that kind of quickly causes you to reconsider the value of your property and the value of your holdings, and maybe you invest in something far different in the future. But I would suggest there that the best way to deal with this is by the judiciary on a case-by-case basis, where they, knowing all the facts, can weigh whether or not there's been some gross abuse of the system.
That does seem to be the actual issue of institutional competence for the judiciary relative to Congress or regulatory agencies, sometimes in the executive branch.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm not announcing any new ideas here. I'm just suggesting they need to be implemented to preserve the patent system.
Dean, I think we'll now go on to some of our follow-on questions from the other audience members.
Yes, sir. We have four follow-on questions now, so you're prodding a lot of people to action here.
Okay.
Yes, Judge Rader, this is David Emerson, a patent attorney and society member in Berkeley, California. Thank you for participating. The question I have for you has to do with the sort of one-size-fits-all approach as to subject matter in the patent law, and the tension that it's almost an irreconcilable tension that I've observed between the areas of biotech, big pharma, and high tech. In one case, it costs upwards of billions of dollars of investment on the front end in order to develop a drug which is dependent on perhaps just one or at most a handful of patents. So it seems in that case, you know, patent law is serving a useful purpose in promoting the progress of science and the useful arts to allow that investment to protect it. And on the other hand, the high-tech side, where often there is a profusion, thousands of patents, each of relatively minimal worth, which could arguably be brought to bear on a complex high-tech product, and any of which, perhaps not in your forum, but in the ITC, could result in an order or bar against importation. So those two sides of the one-size-fits-all subject matter question sort of beg me to ask you whether or not it would be helpful to bifurcate those in terms of the patent policy.
No, I don't think so. This has been a kind of a popular notion in the academic community that there ought to be disparate treatment of different kinds of technology, and some have even proposed different exclusive right periods, you know, the limited right given you by the patent would be shorter for technology than it is for pharmaceuticals, and there's a lot of policy arguments made to this effect. But again, the purpose of the Patent Act is to create technology, and it also has a good deal of attention given to converting that technology into uses by society, a service to the public. And so just the idle academic work, while essential, is not the whole story. And so, in other words, a lot of these problems that you're talking about come after the technology is in place and people are figuring out how to recover their investment in the creation of the technology or to maximize the worth. And the patent system is essentially done most of its work when it gets the technology into the marketplace. And I noticed even as you were posing your example, you quickly kind of validated my point that the problem with these high technology litigation strategies is that they're asserting their small component improvement far beyond its value. And that is a problem. It's one I think that the courts can handle best, as I've suggested. But so I agree with you as to the problem. I think I wouldn't endorse your solution of splitting the Patent Act into various components of technology.
Dean, is there still a queue? Maybe a growing queue?
It's three people. If you would like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone, star, then pound. We've got three questions pending. Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Sancho McCann from Vancouver in Canada. My question is about the inclusion of design patents in the utility patent system versus arising as a sui generis industrial design protection, as in Canada, for example. What are your thoughts on this, particularly regarding issues surrounding the non-obviousness of designs?
Well, first, design can be an area, like all areas of human enterprise, where you can have great creativity and advances, and there's certainly deserving creativity that should have protection in the design area. I think that the systems that we have for protecting design are adequate, and I guess to continue with my theme, I'd say I think the courts can manage them given the proper tools to make sure they work right.
Thank you.
Sure.
Dean, our next question. Dean, our next question, please.
Okay, hold on 1 second.
Hello, Luke Pelican from Washington, D.C. Thank you for the panel. My question is for Judge Rader. You spoke of sort of the injustice you've witnessed in terms of, I suppose, certain patent holders being able to extract more value for their property than it's contributed to society. And I'm wondering the extent to which that might be due to the patent approval process, and in particular, Square area, and what might be done to prevent that injustice from taking place in the future. Thank you.
Well, I hear a lot of talk about patent quality and how we have to devote more effort to patent quality. I read a lot of patents, every month I read, as a matter of fact, as they come to me here. I am not going to sit in judgment of our patent office and say they've done poorly. As a matter of fact, I think they do a marvelous job with their resources. And I know that they are seeking daily to improve their efficiency. Maybe one of the real keys to the future is work sharing amongst the great patent offices of the world, and as they can capitalize on each other's research and limit their own examinations to what they need to do that hasn't been done by others, we might get even a higher quality. But I think the system has done quite well at identifying the technology that needs and deserves protection.
We've got three questions pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Good afternoon. It's Judge Susan Braden in the Court of Federal Claims.
Susan, you're probably sitting downstairs from me somewhere.
I am. Well, I'm always interested in what my chief is interested in. I wanted to make an observation or a comment to the gentleman that was the small inventor, just to be sure he's aware that the Patent Office has issued a notice and comment about the potential of creating a small patent claims forum where a fast-track adjudication of a small claim, and the number they're looking at is $3 million and under, might be achieved. You might want to go to the they're taking comments on that now, and I am pleased to say that the intellectual property section of the ABA had a task force that I chaired this last year, and that the council last week adopted a position paper. It's going through the ABA process now, but it will be public probably in a few weeks. And if the gentleman that called in would like my phone number, I'll give him the information on how he can follow that in the Federal Register. And my number is 202-357-6516. And Dean, at the right time, I think this will be an interesting topic for us to do a separate event on.
I agree, Judge, and I wonder if you would just, in case they weren't prepared, if you want to repeat your phone number.
Yeah, my my number is 202-357-6516. So, and the other thing I wanted to make a brief comment to Chief Judge Rader, which is I'm very concerned about abuse in attorney-client privilege and other privilege assertions in litigation in general, but in patent litigation specifically. And also, this is not the time for this topic completely, but my sense is that there's a tremendous amount of value in the business world about initiating litigation and doing discovery and essentially looking up your opponent's skirt or whatever for a period of time. And, you know, you can drop a lawsuit or settle without any negative consequences. And the value of what you obtain in the business world may be well worth that discovery.
That's kind of a disturbing notion, isn't it, that it can be so widely abused. And let me just add one thing for those who don't know, that Judge Braden is talking about the Patent Office's work on this small claims patent regime. In fact, I think it's more an initiative of Judge Braden herself than anyone else, and she's been a true leader in this area.
Interesting. Yes, Dean, I was just going to suggest the next question.
We do. We have one question pending at this point. If you want to add yourself to the list, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Well, I want to thank Judge Braden for that telephone number and try to follow up on that. This is Chris Garvey again. One of the things that Judge Rader fascinated me about is his efforts to curb in discovery. And whenever people ask me about legal reform, I always say, well, we've got two huge problems. One is that we're trying to find truth, and that the other is we're trying to get an efficient system so it doesn't cost you your life savings to litigate everything. And so I'm wondering exactly what sort of reforms we could do to make discovery more affordable and yet not lose so much of the ability to seek relevant truth to our cases.
Boy, do I get to answer that question?
Well,
please, I could have planted that question. The Federal Circuit's Advisory Council has taken some steps with a model discovery order which limits significantly electronic discovery. Of course, with most records in this era kept electronically, that means that the bulk of discovery efforts these days have moved into the digital world, and the expense of pouring through countless pages of documentary record that's generated by our computers is making litigation a costly and unjust enterprise. It just is not serving any of the objectives of our adjudication system. And so the Federal Circuit's Advisory Council has set forth a model order adopted in probably 7 or 8 districts already to limit the number of record custodians that you can discover in the e-discovery process to 5. And of course, that means the parties have to get together and decide who are the 5 most relevant people. And those are the ones that are subject to the e-discovery after they've, of course, exchanged the central documents of the case that are done, which is done kind of as a routine matter early on.
But does this mean that the people who try to hide documents will put them with all with discovery custodian number 6?
Well, if there's any evidence of that, of course, then you can certainly bring that to the attention of the judge and go beyond the original limits. But, you know, my thought on this is you ask any attorney who's litigated a great deal, and they'll tell you that within 3 months of the filing of the case, they can identify 95% of the documents that are going to be used in the trial. You know what's of value in that trial and what the central issues are. And yet we'll spend another 2 years and $5 million trying to dig into largely extraneous information looking for some potential smoking gun. That's kind of a got-you litigation strategy isn't what our dispute resolution system ought to be about. We ought to be looking at what is this dispute, what are the documents that we all know about within 3 months that we ought to be considering, and then we'll go a little bit beyond that.
A good argument for bifurcation of the trial so that we don't have to worry about the financial documents if there's...
Yeah, well, that's a whole nother area, but and I don't bifurcate my trials, and most district judges are going to be reluctant to do so. That means you've got to either call a jury back or re-educate a whole new jury if you actually are in the trial. So, of course, there are cases where it does look like the merits can be resolved in the liability phase. And I suppose if I saw one of those, I'd quickly bifurcate. But otherwise, efficiencies direct you in a different direction.
Might be a signal.
Dean, do we... Thank you. I just want to make sure that we have enough time for all of the questioners as we're coming up to the close of
our phone lines are wide open at this point. So we've got 6 or 7 minutes left.
Okay. So if you have another follow-up question, please go ahead and ask it.
Yeah, it does seem to be that such an order to bifurcate signal to the plaintiff that he's got problems, that he's likely not to win on the merits.
Perhaps.
Judge Rader, I'd like to, if there's no one else on in the queue anymore, Dean, has anyone else come on?
No, the lines are open.
Okay, then I don't want to close off a question. So, but if there isn't a question, I'd just like to come back to some of the issues that some of the people touched on in the question and answer period, where there were a lot of discussions about creating different forums for litigation, like a small claims court system for patent disputes, splitting patent policy and legal requirements between the high tech world and the pharmaceutical and biotech world, as well as others, this kind of sparked in me the idea that this is part and parcel of a lot of kind of ongoing discussions about extensive systemic reforms in the patent system. And to what extent, Judge Rader, do you think that all of this kind of ongoing systemic reform activity may be exacerbating the exact complaints that people have about patent litigation? Right. So, for instance, has Congress, the FTC, the Supreme Court, and even potentially the Patent and Trademark Office, as it implements a lot of the post-issuance review procedures and other types of other mechanisms for reviewing patent quality, have they created incentives for people to hold out in litigation and not enter into licenses or not settle cases, given a hope, reasonable or not, that that they may be benefited by one of these seemingly imminent reform activities?
It is inevitable that people are going to game the system. Yeah, I mean, that is, there are even economists that have won Nobel Prizes for that kind of analysis. So, yes, that sort of thing's going to happen. I'm not sure I know how much it's happening.
Okay. So we just have a few minutes left. Perhaps do you have any closing remarks that you would like to provide? Any issues that you weren't able to touch upon in your opening remarks, or anything that was brought to mind from the various questions that either I or some of the participants asked?
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Okay. Well, Dean, are there any questions in the queue?
No, our phone lines are still open. If somebody has a final question, they could push star and then pound on their phone.
All right.
Otherwise,
okay. Well, then I think then it seems that questions have been asked. Judge Rader seems comfortable with the issues that have been touched upon.
I put everybody to sleep, maybe, huh?
No, you've satisfied them with your far-ranging and comprehensive answers. So I think that then will bring us to the conclusion of this delightful digital fireside chat in front of a live audience with Chief Judge Rader of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Thank you, Judge Rader, for your willingness to take the time out of your very busy schedule to speak with us today about patent reform, the patent system generally, and specifically issues in patent litigation.
Thank you very much. Appreciated the chance to be with you.
And on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both Judge Rader and our moderator, Adam Mossoff, and our co-sponsor, the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property at George Mason University Law School, for their participation today. I also want to invite our audience to join us tomorrow at noon for our discussion of cybersecurity and the role of the NSA. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.